Hello, and welcome to Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Wadad. This is the first episode of a new show dealing with global geopolitical developments and political change. I thought I'd start us off with a summary of where we are today and what is going on in the world around us. I wanted to give an evaluation of what's happening, what's the West situation, and where do we see things going forward? And more importantly, why is the world the way it is today? The unipolar moment that happened after the end of the Cold War is pretty much over. The Americans are no longer the only major geopolitical player in the world. The Russians have risen, the Chinese have risen, and a bunch of other countries like Turkey and Pakistan and India are able to assert their autonomy and pursue their interests regardless of what the Americans think. More importantly, we are now in a situation where there's a de facto alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. And this is particularly important. If you look at the history of World War I and World War II, the strategic impetus, aside from any moral questions, for the intervention of the United Kingdom and the United States in those wars was to ensure that Russia and Germany didn't form a single combine whereby Russian natural resources would be feeding the German industrial machine, and that combine would then be able to dominate the Eurasian landmass and become a major challenger to a naval power like Britain or the United States. Well, thanks to sanctions on China, pressure on Russia, pressure on Iran, now a much bigger industrial machine, the Chinese industrial machine, can rely on the resources of not just Russia, but also those of Iran as well. And if you just look at a map and accept that, you know, the Chinese have an alliance with Pakistan, you can see that between Russia, China, and Iran and Pakistan, the Eurasian landmass is locked. And all of the resources of Asia and of Russia are going to be feeding an industrial machine that is much more capable than that of the West. If you look at technology today, China is the technological leader in a huge range of industries, including material science, including electronics, including optics. The Chinese are now in a position where they have a military machine that is really incomparable in the size of the industrial base that it can tap. And what matters in a shooting war isn't how advanced your weaponry is today. What actually matters is how sophisticated is your industry and how big is your industrial base and how quickly can you replace equipment and personnel who are lost in combat. That's what matters in modern warfare, not how good the equipment that you have today is, in which the Americans are still excellent. What really matters is how quickly can you replace weapons, ships, aircraft, drones, missiles, ammunition that is depleted during actual combat. And that's where the Chinese advantage is. They have a far bigger, far deeper industrial base than the Americans. The Europeans are not really a geopolitical player anymore. Europe can be best thought of as a theater in which geopolitical competitions take place rather than an actual geopolitical player. Worse than that, the Europeans are deeply wedded to the ideology of net zero, endless immigration, that is just simply destroying European industry, but also European societies. What's happening with Europe is that their reliance on cheap migrant labor is holding back automation. And if you're going to compete in modern industrial warfare, you need a very high amount of automation in order to do so. So the Chinese have an advantage there. More than that, for European countries, if they were to try to fight a war, most of the people who would want to volunteer to join a European military would be considered far right by the European establishment and would be therefore considered unwelcome. So there isn't the right technical capability and there isn't the right spirit to animate a population to rise to the challenges of war. These are the problems that Europe faces. The United States is in a somewhat better position but not by very much. It equally has an immigration problem. It equally has deep internal divisions over race and ethnicity and religion. And it has outsourced way too much of its manufacturing to China and to Asia. When you understand this context, you understand why there is a trade war that's happening between China and the United States. You have to also consider that for decades, the Chinese have been able to essentially take any IP that they want to take, any intellectual property that they want to take, use it, and they're now in a position to develop it and advance it further. In most industries that matter militarily, the Chinese are today ahead. And with the sheer scale of manufacturing and industry that they have in their country, in an actual conflict, they can scale this up and transform that industrial capacity into military industries. So this is where we are, and it's important to understand that. Another point to consider when we're thinking about where is the world today in terms of geopolitics is the fact that the Muslim world is slowly aligning with China. Forget about the Gulf states, who are completely dependent on the United States. I'm thinking about major population centers, like Pakistan, which has just proven itself against India using Chinese weapons and was able to humiliate India in aerial combat, where Chinese weapons demonstrated that they are better than French weapons, at least. You have Turkey, which is building an industrial base all of its own, which is a player in Ukraine, a player in the Caucasus, a player in the Gulf, and in Africa, a major player in Africa. You have countries like Indonesia and Malaysia that are dependent on trade with China and who will pick China rather than the West in any conflict. And you see that there is a massive problem. The bulk of the world's population is aligning against the West and against the United States. And this alliance that has been forced through Western policy that brought together Russia, Iran, and China has the ability to expand and to include countries like Pakistan, Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, and a big chunk of Southeast Asia. This is a winning combination in terms of the scale of the natural resources that are available and the size of the population. And from a Western perspective, this is a much worse outcome than the Germans succeeding against the Russians and getting Russian natural resources to feed the German industrial machine. So the world today is in a position where the West is really on the back foot and has been severely weakened, and it's been severely weakened by its own hands and its own policies. Now, the question that I want to address is, why are we in this mess? The short answer is liberal assumptions about humanity that go against any decent, realistic understanding of human nature. In this show, audience, we want to emphasize that human nature is flawed and that conflict is a permanent feature of life. However, after the triumph of liberalism against the Soviet Union, the leadership of the West seems to have forgotten this lesson. Instead, the leadership of the West assumed that if it traded with China and if it brought China into the international system, then a Chinese middle class would emerge. And that Chinese middle class would naturally seek liberal democracy, because liberal democracy is the end of history. Not just the end as in the termination of history, but even the spiritual purpose of history. This was the assumption that the liberals adopted. They thought that so long as most of the world was included in a free trade framework, everybody was just going to magically get along, and we are going to forget all of our differences. That proved to be highly unrealistic. Rather, the Chinese wanted to pay the West back for the century of humiliation, for the Opium Wars, for the sense that China was inferior. And the Chinese wanted their country to rise as a global superpower. And so they took the investment in manufacturing that was given to them. They took the jobs that were outsourced from the West. They took the technical know-how and the knowledge. that these jobs entail, they took the intellectual property and are now developing it to their own ends. The situation has gotten so severe that now China outproduces the whole rest of the world in just ships. And if you consider that America claims that it is a naval empire, being eclipsed by China in ship production is a major problem. Not just that, the second and third largest producers of ships are South Korea and Japan, countries that are extremely vulnerable to Chinese influence and to China militarily. If you were to just look at a map, frankly, you would see the proximity between Japan and China, and you would instantly, by the way, understand the importance of Taiwan. And let's dive into that for a moment. The island of Taiwan polices the shipping that goes from the rest of the world through the Strait of Malacca, next to Singapore, through the South China Sea, and up to South Korea and Japan. It also polices access to China's most important ports, which are concentrated in the north of the country. So, if the Americans had Taiwan, they could conceivably blockade China. On the other hand, if the Chinese were in control of Taiwan, they could quite easily blockade shipping to Japan and to South Korea, and go further afield from Taiwan and make sure that anything that passes in the Philippine Sea was vulnerable to the Chinese Navy. I wanted to mention that because this is part of what the fight over Taiwan is all about. And the West, instead of realizing that this is a pretty dire geopolitical situation, is mostly focused on stopping Russia in Ukraine. Now, this is extremely reckless because from the perspective of the West, it's really not that important whether the border between Russia and Ukraine sits here or somewhere closer to the Dnieper River. It's really not that big of a deal where the borders of Ukraine actually end up being, because the challenge isn't going to emanate from this relatively small, in the grand scheme of things, piece of territory, rich as it might be in natural resources. The challenge is emerging from the fact that the world's natural resource superpower has been forced into an alliance with the world's manufacturing superpower, and that between them, they can pretty much dominate the entire Eurasian landmass, as I keep saying, and feed the resources of Asia into the Chinese manufacturing machine. Instead of seeing the size of this problem, the focus of the West is where does this line between Russia and Ukraine actually lie, and who controls the eastern side of Ukraine? It's like picking up pennies in front of a train. They're focused on something that's absolutely insignificant, on something that's really of no material importance, but they insist that this is what they want to focus on. Well, why? Largely because they're ideologues. In a wide number of ways. First, they believe that the order that was constructed after the Second World War, and more importantly, after the end of the Cold War, can last forever, when we know, being men of faith, that nothing lasts forever. They believe that borders are inviolable except to them. So, if the leadership of the United States wants to destroy Libya or invade Iraq or send jihadis to Syria or to Afghanistan or to Chechnya, this is absolutely fine. They can do that. Borders are now violable again. If they were told, you've got to police your own borders, and there's always going to be conquest and gains by conquest, they will say, absolutely not. Only we get to do this. It's pride that's primarily animating them, and it's an inability to understand how the world really works. And it's really tragic to be led by people who don't understand the world. Now, not only were they reckless enough to push Russia, China, and Iran together, they also decided that they're going to spend their resources trying to build democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan. They simply assumed that there is no difference between different cultures. They didn't understand that for the West itself, for Europe, the imposition of democracy required two American invasions during World War I and World War II. Justified as you may think these invasions were, it was only through the force of American arms that Europe became democratic, and that Japan and South Korea became democratic. They thought that they could do the same to Iraq and Afghanistan, refusing to respect the differences in culture between those countries and the West. The Muslim world has no tradition of democracy, none. It doesn't have any of the intellectual or cultural underpinnings that are required for it. In the most westernized Middle Eastern country, Tunisia, they got democracy on their own in 2011, and then 10 years later they decided, right, this experiment failed, we want nothing to do with it, let's have a president who can rule as a full-on authoritarian and trust him with power. This is the Middle East organic experiment with democracy. It was one where the public actually rejected it and preferred an authoritarian autocrat to multi-party democracy. But the West didn't want to accept that this was possible. They insisted, or at least I should say the Western leadership, insisted that Iraq and Afghanistan should become democracies. And to that end, they spent $7 billion. $7 trillion, I should say. If it was $7 billion, it would have been acceptable. We've ended up in a position where the West refused to learn the lessons from the story of the Tower of Babel in the Old Testament. To remind you, in that story, Nimrod and his people decide that they were going to equal God and that they were going to build a tower that reaches all the way to heaven. And God looks at this and says, I'm not going to allow it. I'm not going to reward these people's pride. I'm going to give them 999 languages so that the 1,000 builders who were involved in this project could not understand each other. There is a deeper meaning behind that story, which is that whatever you build must remain at a human scale. You can't recreate the world into your image. You can't reach heaven through your own hands, through your own effort. This is the message behind it, meaning that, as far as it applies to geopolitics, that what works in America and Britain, which is parliamentary democracy, will not work in the rest of the world. It was imposed on Europe through force of arms, but it can't be imposed on the rest of the world. And for those of you who say, well, what about Japan? My answer is simple. Wait and see what happens after the American military withdraws from Japan. If it remains as a nominally liberal democracy, but in effect a one-party state, we'll see. I will bet money that it wouldn't, and that democracy would end in Japan the minute that the last American soldier leaves Japan. Same for South Korea. However, the people that govern today refuse to understand the world in this way. They refuse to understand that there are limits to their power and limits to their ideology. In a sense, they've also forgotten the story of Cain and Abel. In the story of Cain and Abel, we have, in essence, the first two men, the first children of Adam and Eve, ending up in a position where one of them murders the other. The story doesn't explain why. It isn't clear if it's because one was a husbandsman and the other was a farmer. It isn't clear if it's jealousy or wrath or pride. It was most probably all of the above. Nobody explains why this happened. But the message of the story is even worse. It is that no matter what the reason is, humans are naturally in conflict. If they try to build too high, it will be another Tower of Babel, or it will be another Cain and Abel. And it doesn't matter which route you take to reach that conclusion. If you start with evolution and assume that we are just the cousins of the chimpanzees, that leaves you in pretty much the same place. Chimpanzees naturally organize military patrols and go around their territory in silence, looking for males from rival clans to murder them. And when their own clan becomes too big, it just breaks up. That's human nature. We can't have a global system because we're human. And there is never going to be a single global system that reigns peacefully unchallenged. That never works. The fate of every empire is to decay and fall. And what we're seeing with the United States, frankly, is that this decay is set in. And it's set in quite considerably. And that's one of the themes that this show is going to be dealing with time and time and again. A couple of more comments on human nature, if you will be so kind as to tolerate me. If you ask yourself, well, will this ever be solved? Will we ever all get along? The answer is always going to be no, we won't. Human beings naturally divide by blood and by faith. And you need shared blood and shared faith to have peace. Take the example of Iraq. It's divided by ethnicity between the Kurds and the Arabs. And the Arabs will generally side together against the Kurds. And the Kurds will generally rally to one another and support each other. The ethnic divide is always going to be there. But if you look deeper, there are many, many tribal divides that are also always going to be there. If you look at Lebanon or Syria, these are countries with pretty much the same ethnicity. All of the people there, for the most part, aside from the Kurds, have the same ethnicity. However, the divides between Christians, Druze, Muslims, and others is simply irreparable. It's not enough that they share ethnicity. Same stories in the Balkans. There's no ethnic difference between the Bosnians and the Croats and the Serbs, but their religious division is so overwhelming that that conflict will always be there. If you look at the United States, for the most part, the black community is Christian. For the most part, the white community is Christian. The divide between them is always going to be there because they're divided by ethnicity. It is in our nature to divide ourselves by ethnicity, by tribe, by race, by religion. And even then, there are always going to be some divides between the same community that does share the same ethnicity and that does share the same religion. We see it from the civil wars of Europe that happened over centuries. We know about them because they're well documented, but in fact, civil wars are part and parcel of everybody's history. So this is what I wanted to sort of get across, that conflict is natural, and that's what animates politics. What's geopolitics then? Geopolitics deals with how geography affects the manner in which societies are organized, and it deals with how geography affects human divisions. That's what geopolitics means. So I want to take the example of a country like, say, Iran. Iran is a highly fractured country with dozens of different ethnicities. These different ethnicities must be controlled through a strong central state. The biggest vulnerability of Iran isn't external invasion. The country is too mountainous for external invasion to really be a huge threat. It's fragmentation that comes from the ethnic divisions within Iran. And it's the fact that the different ethnicities will pull the country in different directions. And so a wise ruler of Iran will try to use a combination of repression and religion in order to keep the country together. And if you look at how the Shah of Iran behaved back when he was in power before 1979, and how the modern Islamic Republic of Iran operates, it's pretty much the same thing. They both had very strong and effective secret police. That secret police was used to subdue the vast bulk of the population and to keep them under control. And their reason that they had to do it by coercion is because different communities in the mountains could easily fortify some mountain passes and deny access to the state's forces and therefore try to secede or become independent. So it becomes necessary to preempt that through suppression. Another country to think about in terms of the geopolitics is Russia. If you take a Russian perspective on the world, everything around Russia looks like a threat. So I wanted to show you this map of Moscow's perspective on the world. If you look at the world from Moscow, you see something slightly different. You see to the Far East, Mongolia and China, and the risk of invasion from Mongolia and or China of Russia's Far Eastern provinces. You see from the Caucasus the risk of the Turks or the Persians crossing the mountains of the Caucasus and invading the flatlands of Russia and going up the Volga and threatening to take away pieces of Russian territory. You see from the West the great powers or the great potential powers like Germany and maybe Poland that can at some point decide that they're going to try to take their share of Russian territory. And you see the Scandinavians, who might at any point decide that they want to threaten St. Petersburg and try to challenge the Russians there. So the Russian perspective on the world is that everybody looks like a threat. Not only that, it's surrounded by either middling or great powers, and it can be invaded from any direction because most of the country is flat. Add to it that for the most part, Russia has very few navigable rivers relative to its size. Therefore, the construction of roads, which is absolutely necessary to be able to defend yourself militarily, is almost entirely dependent on the Russian state. This means that the state must have a massive role in the economy no matter what. And that automatically leads to statism and authoritarianism. So geopolitics is the claim that the way Russia is set up geographically and culturally means that it must always have an authoritarian state. The way that Iran is set up geographically and culturally means that because of the mountains, there is always going to be different ethnic communities that go up the mountain and try to defend themselves, and that the only way to police them and control them is to be able to use repression. And that's a fundamental story from, say, Britain, which has a huge number of navigable rivers as well as the ability to impose a strong central state, especially in England. And that's fundamentally different from America, which is isolated from the rest of the world by a bunch of oceans, by two oceans, and which has, through the Mississippi River Basin, the largest network of navigable rivers in the world, as well as the largest chunk of irrigable land in the world, meaning that America is always going to be a superpower in food and in natural resources, meaning that America is always going to be a great power, even if it falls behind sometimes, unless, of course, it somehow gets partitioned. So geopolitics really deals with these kinds of questions. It deals with the intersection of geography and politics, but it also has a bit of a missing component in that it must also account for culture and human nature. It's not enough to think just in terms of geography. It's not enough to think just in terms of material lessons. One of the big things that I learned in my career as an analyst is that the material explanation isn't enough, but is necessary to consider. We must think about material conditions, but it isn't enough. So the way to think about the United States today and why it's in decline, even though it has this massive wealth of resources, is that because human nature, when it gets too comfortable, gets rotten. When things go very well for us and we're not sufficiently challenged, we no longer have the energy or the impetus to rise to the occasion. Rather, we become a little bit lazy and a little bit complacent. And we assume that the good times that we have or that we had will always last. And that seems to have affected a lot of the West. This confidence that the things that happen everywhere else in the world, civil wars, ethnic conflict, won't happen here. And this assumption has proven to be extremely destructive, I would argue. And one of the things that I want to do in this show is introduce this idea, is to sort of give a bit of a spiritual accounting of politics and try to be realistic by admitting that we are in fact spiritual beings as well as flesh and blood, and that the way we think and that the ideologies that animate us have a material impact rather than remaining merely in the realm of ideas. So my hope with this show is to be able to bring a sense of reality and realism to the discussions of geopolitics. It's my hope that we can account for the spiritual as well as the material. It's my hope that we can think in multiple layers rather than just, you know, who has the best military technology or who has the biggest economy or whatever. And to be able to have a perspective that respects human nature as it is, that accepts how we operate in the world rather than tries to impose theories, be they material or spiritual, on the world. Thank you so very much for watching, and I really hope you enjoy the show.